attention, please. Can I have your attention, please? The Box World, everyone. My name is Sadia Jable. Nathaniel Hawkins, I would like to say you forever as freestyle very soon.
It's now time
to start 5 DCs for Sabbath services.
May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? Shabbat Shalom, everyone. My name is Sonny Israel, Yedeo Hawkins, and I'd like to serve forever as a priest starting very soon. I would now like to introduce to you the sons and daughters of Israel now entering the sanctuary. I would now like to turn it over to Stefania Hawkins.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. Maybe seated. The title of my speech is The Gods Had Nothing to Do with Creation. If we could get everyone to read the Book of Yahweh, they would see that the gods only destroy, they do not create. In the 17th book of Yisrael, chapter 45, and verse 16, it says, they took the name Yahweh out and pretended the Creator was God and that God created the earth. Those are all lies. It was Yahweh alone who did these things, and his prophets say that. Yahweh's prophets were persecuted because every prophet brought forth the laws of Yahweh with no exception. They brought forth Yahweh's laws and his prophecies. I think I've covered enough there. There are 4,199 religions in the world in this generation that ignore the only way to life given in the inspired scriptures. And the path the world is following will lead to destruction, which will burn the earth and leave human alive. Please turn to Isaiah 24, verse 6, final page 544. It says, because of this, the curses of Yahweh the earth, and they who dwell in therein are desolate. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. Yahweh says in the scriptures that before him there was no God that was formed. Please turn to Isaiah 43, verse 10. Found on page 557. It says, you are my witness, says Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, so that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there is no God El formed, nor will they be after me. In the 17th book of Yisrael, chapter 4, and verse 70, it says, I just read it to you. This verse is speaking of Yahweh's ability to create and to foretell. These words refer to his creation and his foretelling. Before me, no God's created anything. That's what he's saying. Before me, no God's created anything. If you read it and study it, you'll see that what I'm saying is true. After me, after my creation, he says, after my creation, there will be no other class of beings formed. After my creation, you see that? It's the only thing that makes sense. They lie and say that God created the earth, everything, in order to deceive the people into worshiping the gods instead of worshiping Yahweh. We in the house of Yahweh are not deceived. We've been taught the truth. Please turn to Romans 6, verse 22 through 23, found on page 878. But now that you have been set free from sin and have become servants to Yahweh, the benefit you reap leads to holiness and the end result is eternal life. For the wages of sin is death. But the gift of Yahweh is eternal life through Yeshua Messiah, our Savior. If we believe Yahweh and turn from sin, we can have eternal life in Yahweh's kingdom. May Yahweh bless your understanding. And I'd like to turn it over to the next speaker.
The great Deacon Antithea Hawkins.
Shabbat shalom, great saints. You may be seated. I hope everyone is enjoying this weather, this beautiful Shabbat. May the peace of Yahweh be with each and every one of you. The sermon today, training Yahweh's faithful servants. Training Yahweh's faithful servants or faithful flock. We would like to start off in Kefa. Let's turn to Kefa. We've got quite a bit to cover today. Kefa, page 960. We're starting off in First Kefa, chapter 5. Okay, and we're going to look at more encouragement and admonishment more than anything else. Let's look at verse 2. It said, "Feed the flock of Yahweh, which is among you, serving as overseers, not by constraint, by being forced, but willingly, not from eagerness for filthy lucre, but from eagerness to serve." This desire that we should have to serve each other in building this house, in building this work up, this investment that Yahweh has put in us, each and every one of us here today, and Sakam and those who are looking from afar off, all of you have a part of this too, in this work. It's to serve. Your line of service to each other is the key, one of the greatest key to have for this work in these last days. Verse 3, not as arrogantly running over Yahweh's inheritance, right? Not run over Yahweh's inheritance. When you think of that word inheritance, when you inherit something, we are Yahweh's family, we are his children, his sons and daughters. Let's go, verse 4. "And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive a crown of glory, which will not fade away. It will be forever. The reward we are working for is forever. It's not a temporary thing." So, you know, it will take some time and it will be some hard training. If you listen even to the sermons last week and before that, it's more being pushed that we need to really pay attention to ourselves, how we interact, how we deal with each other, how we treat each other. Verse 5, "In the same way, you younger, submit yourself to those who are elders, those in authority. Yes, all of you be subject one to another." He's tying it all in as one family. "And be clothed with humility." Wasn't a few weeks ago, beautiful overseer told us the keys to the kingdom, a white garment, humility. "For Yahweh," what? "He resists the proud, but give mercy to the humble." Those who humble themselves, those who say tether to the branch, to the work in these last days. "Therefore humble yourself under the mighty hand of Yahweh, in order that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your cares," all our cares. We cast all our cares upon him. For a father is a loving heavenly father. He cares for his creation, all his creation. Remember even Yahshua said, didn't bruise a broken reed? You think he's just talking about a twig or a stick on the grass? We all come here with a lot of bruises, a lot of carnality that we have to overcome. And we have to be very careful how we treat and deal with each other in that overcoming process. In the book, The Mark of the Beast, Mark of the Beast, Volume 1, I didn't bring that one with me. In the introduction, it was talking about how Yahweh is a wise being. He's a wise being who takes care of his people, of his children. He takes care of us. He sees our needs. And he have a shepherd, a leader over us, an overseer, who does the same thing. Maybe things that you think you might want, but our needs are met. Is that not right? True concern in the book of Israel, number four, the reverence of Yahweh. True concern there is to show well-being. This is the 18th sermon in the book of Israel, and that's verse 132. You could read it. But it talks about true love and concern is for the well-being of each other. It's not a lustful thing. And Pastor told us, well, yes, you can lust after righteousness, and that's great. That's what we think about him. He loves his scripture so much. That is a great example of humility. That he loves the scripture so much. Think about the things we love today. You know? I've seen in times where if a phone got taken away from someone, they'll lose all control. It's not an easy thing. Think about that attachment to something that has minimum use to our salvation. Yet it has such a strong hold. I recall myself when I said I would never get an iPhone. I believe this is number 8 I have now. You know? I saw a commercial on the television that was talking about bringing back the Razor phone now. You know, and it's such a pull. But we want to look at some of these examples of true care and concern. Let's go to Genesis. You know, let's look at some example of people who had this care and concern. And let's look at something here in Genesis chapter 33. Make sure I'm staying on track. Yes. I want to see the protection here and how this man was brought up. Let's go to verse 1. And if just to familiarize you with these stories, if we go back, it's Esau and Jacob. Remember the two brothers. One sold his birthright, and then also Jacob ended up getting the blessing in return at the end. So there was a little jealousy between both. Let's look at verse 1. Now Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and there was Esau coming, and with him were 400 men. That's a lot of men, right? So he divided, pay attention to this. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservant and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Yosef last. I will encourage you to read a story if you get the time today. Let's go over to verse 14. Let's start at 13. But Jacob said to him, my brother, knows that the children are weak. My brother knows that the children are weak. Now you might think you're just talking about a physical weakness here. No, it's not. Talking about just a physical weakness. And the flock and the herd which are nursing the infants are with me, and if the man should drive them harshly, hard, one day all the flock will die. Please let my brother go ahead in front of his servant. I would lead slowly. That word slowly is gentle. It's protection. It comes from the Hebrew word 3:28. At a pace which the livestock with me and the children are able to what? Endure. The scriptures say, yes, count it all joy when we go through various things. And our suffering builds a character that Yah wants in us. Again, I encourage you to take time to read through the story, but get the understanding here of leadership. The last time I spoke and I showed a video with the plant, one thing I didn't mention is that the two plants in that video both had received everything the same, except how they were treated. Everything was the same except how they were treated. They received the same amount of food, water, light, everything. The only difference was that. We, the strong, ought to bear with the weak. Isn't that right, Great House of Yahweh? That's part of our training, to be able to bear with those who are weak, those who are tender. It doesn't mean that they give us any license to sin or give us the rights to not be corrected. Correction, no correction, seems great at first. But what does it do? I got corrected this morning. Something I did wrong. And I'm thankful for the correction. I really am. Not too long ago, someone had texted me, and they said, "I need your forgiveness." And I never thought about it like that before. So he need my forgiveness. When we do something to each other, how do we, "Will you forgive me? Forgive me? Please forgive me?" We cool, right? I mean, what is it? You need forgiveness. Why you need forgiveness? Why such an emphasis like that? This is a need. I was really taken because it's someone I really look up to. That was saying that to me, that I need your forgiveness. That word also in Genesis drive was talking about overdrive, overworked, and so forth. It's from word 1849, to knock, to press severely. And then I already told you about the word slowly. Now, I want to move to something here. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 18. And as we turn in there, there's something I want to show you. In 1995, there was a story of a twin. I remember I could see the picture here. Anyone have ever heard of the kangaroo keer? We know what that means, the kangaroo keer. You know, a kangaroo keeps their young in their pouch and in front of them, you know, and protecting them. Now, you can see the two infants there, right? And how one put an arm over the other. Everyone see that? Everyone see that? Okay, look at the very top what it said. The twins whose hug changed healthcare and they are now teenagers. This is what it said here. In 1995, the two young ladies spent their first few weeks in separate incubators fighting for their lives. One of the girl's breathing became shallow and her heart rate dropped drastically. Miraculously, a quick-thinking nurse decided, and this is after they try everything, decided to put the two in the same incubator. The other young lady immediately reached over and put her arms around her, stabilizing her heart, and her temperature returned to normal almost instantaneously. I'm not saying we need to go around and touching each other. But there's a powerful message here. The affection. How we affect each other with our thoughts, with our words, with our actions, right? How we interact with each other. That word touch means to attach oneself. Attach oneself, that's like the Levite, to join, to separate. Separate from what? We separate him from sin and join ourselves to this work. None of us wouldn't be here or have any thoughts of this house if it wasn't for a great teacher. If Yahweh in his wisdom didn't set aside this work, What would be the reason for us to be here? What would we be doing? Who would be guiding us? Everything that comes from the house of Yahweh in these last days is for our benefit. Yahweh's family is the most important thing to him. We are the apple of his eyes, his treasure. His treasure. Think about something you value so much, that you protect it. You hide it. You don't even let everyone knows about it. Because you value that so much. And you check on it every time you get the opportunity. In Yahweh's case, he's checking us all the time. We are right there in front of him, always, as the apple of his eyes. Also, that word means a contract. We are in a contract agreement. Upon baptism, we agreed to live our life and to convert to a certain way of life. We agreed to do everything in our power to get away from this worldly way of thinking. We agree to work with each other and build each other up. As a family, we made these agreements that we will love the house of Yahweh. Did it say less or more? What did it say, house of Yahweh? More than all else. So do you not think we're going to go through some tests and trials? Yes, we will. In the Unveiling of Satan, page 372. I want to read something here. The Unveiling of Satan book. Page 372. When Yahweh's laws are taught, people turn from evil. Now, I want to read here. It said, if children are never taught the laws of Yahweh, they don't know what to avoid. If they are not guided to righteousness, their nature will usually be to do unrighteousness. We will form in sin and iniquity. Psalms 51:5. However, when Yahweh's laws are taught to children, listen, children, they have a guideline to keep them from evil. I'm reading on page 373 now. And the title here is All Things Are Done According to Yahweh's Plan. Many who claim to have the truth will try to make you believe that Yahweh, when he created the earth and mankind to dwell upon it, made a mistake. However, nothing is further from the truth. Yahweh, our Heavenly Father and Creator, is very intelligent. He is a very intelligent being. It was no surprise to Yahweh that mankind fell into Lucifer's deception. He wasn't scratching his head, figuring out what he's going to do now. How are you going to turn this thing around? What are you told Yeshua? Could you take a hook out of Babylon? Yahweh is not a confused being. He doesn't need our counsel. In fact, it was no surprise to him that Lucifer rebelled against his laws. This is someone he trained, given a job, show her everything. She wanted more. She wanted more. Page 362, in the Unveiling of Satan. Time for testing. Due to the fact that Lucifer and one-third of the Malachim had turned to sin, the breaking of Yahweh's laws, 1 Jacob 3:4, Yahweh now has prime subjects by which to try his chosen people. This is a training. Lucifer and all the fallen Malachims could now be and are being used to test human being with their persuasion and influential power. Her persuasion and her influential power. I'll just show you one of them. I think I want to stop there on that book. I need to go to the Mark of the Beast, also part two, on page 293 first, in the Mark of the Beast. Again, the testing of your faith, on page 293. This is the Mark of the Beast, volume 2. Okay, that's showing you the book. It said here, through the parable of the sower, Yahshua also showed the trial that would come. The first trial come when Satan the adversary tries to make you doubt the faith. Faithful flock, faithful servant. And that, you heard that last week, some of that said last week in the great house of Yahweh here. Yahweh has shown unto you when you brought into the body of Messiah the house of Yahweh. He showed these things. There are those who do not understand. It is usually because of the lack of understanding that many fall away. You may not understand everything the very first time you hear it. Yahweh's truth, you realize, is not taught in the churches and assemblies. No, it's not. It's totally different. Pay attention to here. You will be presented the truth. And it will be upon you to what? To be humble enough to accept it. Bow our ear to accept it. We have to humble ourselves to receive it. We can't receive it no other way. You're at Luke now? Are you in Luke? I said it's Luke 18, right? Luke 18. Look at verse 15. We're starting there. Page 804. Luke chapter 18, verse 15 is where we started. Now they also brought infants to him, that he might, again, not just a physical touch he is talking about. Remember that word touch means to attach, to join, to separate from a certain way of life. But when his disciples saw this, what did they do? They rebuked them. But Yahshua summoned them to him and said, "Permit little children to come to me, and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of Yahweh." Look at verse 17. "Truly I say to you, whoever will not accept the kingdom of Yahweh like a little child." You ever really thought about that scripture right there? Whoever will not accept the kingdom of Yahweh as a little child. How does a little child accept the kingdom of Yahweh? Does my 4-year-old son know how to accept the kingdom of Yahweh? What is it saying there? Whoever will accept the kingdom of Yahweh like a little child. That humility. That lowliness in heart. Not being puffed up with pride. Boastful. Remember 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 13, the love scripture. Not being puffed up with pride. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not boastful. See what I say? Will certainly never enter into it. Certainly. That's no doubt. Yahweh is certain about that. And he knows every one of us. He knows us. He knows the here in our head. It's amazing. So there's no getting away with Yahweh on these things. That's why you look at the heart, not just a physical person before you. Because some of us, we still battling those things, the physical looks and things. Look at the heart. Look at the works. Actions speak louder than words. Praise Yahweh. Let me see. We go here to page 294. Page 294. This is just continuing in the Mark of the Beast, volume 2, page 294. And you can take notes, take these things down. I want to read a paragraph here. It says, "Many times the cares of mankind..." So the cares for making a living become stronger than the word of Yahweh. We are commanded to practice. That we are commanded to practice. Life's pressures can become very strong. And many times people will reason that they just have to do certain unlawful things because they need the money. So Yahshua showed the word of Yahweh is choked out. It's one of the parables referring to Matthew chapter 13. Also that the person has fallen away from salvation. These tests and trials come in many forms, whether you're young, whether you're old. That's why I'm quoting these things. From the youngest to the oldest, we will go through various things that will build and shape that individual character to what Yahweh need to see in that individual at that time. Now, as young men and women, you are going through your tests right now too. Because when I read that scripture in Genesis, if you notice how this man was protecting his family, why? Why would it be so important to put the youngest last? If you caught that. Yahweh has a great job for his children, for his people. And Satan has a great job too. There's two works, and that is it. We either fall in line with Yahweh's work or Satan's work. There's no option, brothers and sisters. There's no gray area in between. If you think you got time out to go and hang out somewhere to get your mind clear, Pastor said where to go. He said go in the closet. Right? You don't have to go on no vacation to do that. We are in this struggle together. Iron will sharpen iron. This testing, again, brothers and sisters, is to build our faith in Yahweh and belief. Law number one, believe in Yahweh, the only source of power in the universe. We're still learning law number one. What is law number two? God? I hear two different things. How's Yahweh? Law number two. You got to submit if you want to love. Our children need to be learning these things day in and day out, teaching them, encouraging them in the way of righteousness. You know, if we see a problem, we need to know to deal with these things respectfully. No one should feel uncomfortable because you're already uncomfortable. Knowing when we just messed up, we did something wrong. You already know you're wrong. You want to act strong, but you know you're wrong. And sometimes when you're being corrected, you feel as all is occurring that you feel is that somebody just beating down with you. No, Yahweh is not doing that. Yahweh is shaping in you his character. Satan will want you to feel that way because she wants to pull at you. She wants to pull you out of this great work, thinking that you somehow the world is so free that you'll have a better life out there. I'm not going to talk about the world. I'm not talking about the world right now. But I know the pulse of Satan is strong. And we have to consider each other. How we communicate. Communication is a big thing. Page 99 in the self-control unit. Last time I spoke to you about the attack speech. How do you attack the problem, not the person? How? The person is sitting in front of you. They're not wanting to speak. What are you going to do? The key is to get them to communicate. How will we really even know what we're helping if they don't communicate? One of the great priests in Yahweh's great house, I spent many years with, we never move on in counseling if it wasn't progress. We never move forward. And even when I ask other things, you will bring me back. Bring me back. We haven't got this covered yet, Antithea. Why are you worrying about that? Let's concentrate on this. Yahweh wants to see you get this right first. Everyone experiences conflict or disagreement. Conflicts can occur between friends, between brothers, between sisters, between each other. We are all different. We all have different likes and dislikes. and different moods. What makes each person tick is very uncomplex. It varies and complex. Because of this, no two people are alike or see eye to eye at all times. Coming down, it said, however, conflict or disagreement should never be an excuse to be rude or disrespectful. To be rude or disrespectful. Even though we are all unique individuals with various opinions and values, we can learn to coexist peacefully. The key is to treat each other respectfully, even when we disagree. We've been taught that in the peaceful solution, agree to disagree. Could you play the first clip? The song?
You teach your children through your example. They will follow what you say and do. How you communicate to each other is how they'll talk to you.
Remember that song? You like it? You want to hear more? Play the next clip.
Teach them all of Yahweh's laws, so they may have life eternal.
Turn to page 896 for a closing scripture. That is a beautiful song. It still resonates to this day. And how we communicate with each other is how they will communicate with us, right? And I want to end with this scripture, the love. Love in the house of Yahweh. I will say in your spare time, read the entire thing. Look at verse. We start with verse 11. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. When I became a man, I put away childish things. Train up a child, so when they grow old, they wouldn't depart from it. Now we are looking in a mirror that gives only a blurred reflection, but when face to face with perfection, now I know in part, but then I will fully know, even as I am now fully known. But now these three things endure: faith, hope, and love. All caring, kind, positive ways to work with each other. But the greatest of these is what? It's love. stay faithful. Wait on Yahweh. Be thankful that we have the blessed opportunity to come to those gates every time and be in this house, this great work of Yahweh, great saints of Yahweh. I thank you for your time. If you will please stand. And now, to continue on this great Shabbat, introduce the great Deacon Micaiah Meisner Hawkins.
Shabbat Shalom, saints of Yahweh. Please be seated. We're going to continue exploring the lot Pastor received in his dream. So I'm going to start with a quick recap. This might be a quick work. May I have my first slide, please? When I spoke previously, we covered Pastor's lot in the Hebrew gematria of what the numbers inscribed on the stone meant. 17, 28, 74, they described a man called Witness. And what he would do, remember, one who is a witness, who brings forth the strength of Yahweh, the laws and the prophecies. He will sprinkle with the water of purification and will bring forth the rejoicing. Remember, he's brought back, he restored Yahweh's Sabbath, feast, the holy calendar, all which marks us. Next slide, please. Then we went over Pastor's full license plate. GMK 1074, and what it means. It identifies him as Zerubbabel, the one opposing Babylon. Next slide. Then we went over the perfect code, 70 times 70, or 490, showing the standard of perfection of Yahweh, his perfect character represented by the white lodestone, which was identified as Tamim. And how the code is used in Zechariah 3, where the branch receives this stone, in Zechariah 4, Zerubbabel receives the stone. In other words, the fulfilled prophecy showing who the man is who would receive this white stone according to the law of Yahweh through the high priest who established the house in these last days. He has the authority to bring forth a work and to teach, no one else. We're about to go into that last 3.5 years of the 7-year period, the end of the 490-year period, that signifies perfection, a perfection of a holy priesthood, the end result. Today, we'll see that the same white lodestone in Pastor's dream shows the time and place all of this would occur, along with some other very interesting information. I think it's interesting. My title today is The Lot Says It All, Part 3, The End. Next slide. Adding Pastor's lot numbers 17, 28, and 74, we get 119. 119 is Hebrew word kit, which is actually found in Hebrew lexicons under the alternate spelling of the Hebrew word kitz, in a shortened form and two-letter root kitz. The proof for that is shown in these next two references, a Hebrew English lexicon of the Old Testament by William Gesenius, translated by Edward Robinson, and also the Analytical Hebrew and Chaldee Lexicon by Benjamin Davidson. We'll be looking up those words. Next slide. A Hebrew and Chaldee lexicon to the Old Testament by Julius I, translated by Samuel Davidson, shows the word carries a meaning of harvest, proceeding from the idea of cutting off or reaping. It also means a cutting off of a point of time, a finishing up, as the following references show. Hebraic Tongue Restored by Fabre de Olivet, a new Hebrew English lexicon by William Osborne Jr. That which cuts, limits, terminates, finishes a thing, that which is final, action of cutting off, end. And also a manual Hebrew An English Lexicon by Josiah Gibbs, a Compendious Hebrew Grammar by M.H. Breslov, and a Compendious and Complete Hebrew and Chaldee Lexicon to the Old Testament by Benjamin Davies and carefully revised by Edward C. Mitchell. So this means an end, the end of fulfillment of a prophecy, the end of a prophecy, the end of time, that is the kingdom of Messiah. It also shows destruction, and it's used in Daniel 12:13, of the time of the end, the last days. We'll get back to Daniel 12 a little later. All of these references together show the word in a nutshell means the cutting, reaping of the harvest, and the cutting off, a limiting of time. It signifies the time period of the end and the finishing of a work. We know the world brings about an end by their own actions. And there's a work done in that, there is a work done in that time period, that last generation, by a man who establishes a house in that age and brings about the ending of the way of the evil of the gods. Remember, Matthew 13:39, the harvest is the end of the age. The harvest is the end of the age. How amazing is that? What kind of coincidence is it that his lot numbers would add up to 119 and mean the end? The end of man's governments being evil like the gods, an end generation, and that this man, Israel Hawkins, would even write a book called The End. Did you notice today's date on the calendar? 119:19. Only Yahweh could plan for this to be brought today. And my plans don't go that well. 119 is the end, and Pastor talked about what 19 means. Next slide, please. Seventh Book of Israel, Part 1, Chapter 21, Verse 20 through 25. I'll be reading the highlighted versions because we're pressed for time. From this book, from E.L. Bullinger, and it shows the number 19. And he says, thus marks the end. It marks the end. Did you get that? It marks the end and is thus significant of the conclusion of a matter. Bullinger also shows that the number 9 is significant of the end of man and the summation of all of man's works. Bullinger then says that the number 9 is therefore the number of finality of judgment. Get that? Get that? Number 19. This Hebrew letter, Tet, is used as a number 9 in biblical Hebrew. This letter is listed on pages 96 and 356 of part 1 of the Hebraic Tongue Restored by De Olivet, which shows that this letter means the sign of resistance and protection. Resistance and protection, the symbol or representation of the shelter of man or shield. Remember, Yahweh is our shield and buckler. His righteousness is the gird of our loins. The number 10, page 243 to 250 of number in Scripture by Bullinger, which shows this number is a number which marks the protection of man's order commencing a new series. Bullinger then says, completeness of order marking the entire round of anything is therefore the signification of the number 10. Nothing is wanting. That the number and order are perfect, that the whole cycle is complete. The Hebrew letter Yod is used as a number 10 in biblical Hebrew. This letter is listed on page 96, 360, and 361, the Hebraic Tongue Restored by De Olivet, which shows this letter is a symbol of all manifested power and eternity, which is, of course, Yahweh, 19. Next slide. Matithya 24, verses 3, 13 through 14, and 33 through 34. When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? But he who endures until the end, the same will be saved. And this message of the kingdom will be preached to all the world by the one who bears witness to all nations, and then the end will come. The end of the age is near. That generation will not pass away. This next reference shows, next slide, please. The Hebrew word also refers to a cutting off of sleep. There's a lot more to this word than just end. An awakening, a calling out during this time. This refers to the first resurrection from the dead at the end of this time period. Gesenius Hebrew and English Lexicon of the Old Testament by Francis Brown. Awake from sleep of death, of resurrection. It's used in Job 14:12 and Daniel 12:2, shown here. If you look at Daniel 12, verse 1, at that time, one who is like Yahweh will stand. Verse 2, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. This is the Hebrew word awake, is Keats. Dust of the earth, take note of that. We're going to be covering that. So we see it is the cutting off of death, awakening from the sleep of death, referring to a time of resurrection in the time of the end by a work, a finishing work. Next slide. This word is not only a point in time when all these things occur, it also designates a place. According to a Hebrew and Chaldee lexicon by Samuel Davidson, it says, Kets, notice it's not only a time, a place. Isaiah 41:6-9. But you, O Israel, are my servant, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth. Ends of the earth. Keats is used here in Isaiah 41:9 for the ends of the earth. Another reference is a Hebrew and English lexicon without points by Parkhurst. We know that the last day's end period generation began in 1934 with the birth of Israel Hawkins, the witness this lot was given to. And it started in the ends of the earth, in the end of time, this time period. Next slide. 10th Book of Israel, Part 2, Chapter 26, verses 92 through 98. Pastor says, to build the house of Yahweh according to the standard of perfection sent by Yahweh's laws in a Babylonish land which does not yet exist. And it will be established at that time. Yeshua said, we're going to see this. It's something you can see in that time period when the two witnesses are called out to their work as the established place, the habitation of Yahweh, the house of Yahweh. A land that does not exist, Zechariah. Now, if you go back to Isaiah 41 and remember these prophecies, Isaiah 41:8, he says, but you, Yisrael, my servant, Yaakov, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend, verse 9, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth. The word ends here represents something that's done last or something that's established last. The earth, ends of the earth, Oklahoma was the last land. They had a run for it, the Oklahoma run. I don't know how many has read about that, but the Oklahoma run was to let this last land of Oklahoma go out to a certain group of people whom I would say Yahweh chose. I'd say there was some inspiration because Yahweh was working at that time to establish or to get a person ready to establish his house, and nothing was done that was outside this plan concerning me, my life, and Yahweh, and the house of Yahweh, Yahweh's work. But Oklahoma, they had this land run after all the rest of the places were established. Is the ends of the earth, but this is the ends of the earth. Oklahoma was the ends of the earth and called you from the farthest parts of it. The weakest parts of it was Purcell in Oklahoma. The ends of the earth, spoken of prophetically in Isaiah 41:9, started in the area of Purcell, Oklahoma. This was the beginning of the generation leading to the full establishment of the house of Yahweh at Abilene at Abel. This is all shown in Pastor's lot. How incredible is that? Let's take a closer look at this place where this generation of a man started, Oklahoma and Purcell. Next slide. 15th Book of Israel, chapter 33, verse 4. Does anyone know what Oklahoma means? The word Okla means people. The word Homa is actually pronounced Huma. It actually means red. There are a few people around with red complexions, red hair. All of my family were. My uncles and aunts had red hair or were red complexion. This word, it's a symbolic color. It means life. It means life. According to an online etymology dictionary, Oklahoma, literally, red people. Interesting enough, Pastor's mother's maiden name was Russell, which means red. And that's according to etymology dictionary also. A Hebrew and Chaldee lexicon by James Strong, says there's another word that means red. Here you can see the Hebrew word for red, or ruddy, is listed in Strong's as 119. believe it or not. It also means to show blood. And 120 is the same word without the vowel points. 120 is from 119, means ruddy, mankind. It's the word Adam. In Hebrew gematria, 119 indicates the end generation of a man, a certain man. This is about a work put into action by the only man authorized by the high priest and given that lot stone. It had to be from mankind, Adam. It can't be from an earlier creation of the sons of Yahweh. It had to be a son of man born in weak flesh. The gods fight against this. You can see it in the scriptures. The demons refuse to admit that Yeshua started in the flesh. All authority will be given to Adam, man, mankind, as it says in Genesis 1:26. This word Adam designates and shows, it's a very interesting word, this word Adam designates and shows a genetic transfer, a copying of a pattern. According to Hebraic Tongue Restored, Fabre de Olivet, the two-letter root of the word Adam, dam or dom, means that which is identical. It's a copy. It is blood or bloodline in the Hebrew. It refers to the genetics, making image-like copies. I remember back in the day, my grandfather and father, they were horse dealers, and they talked about bloodline of the horses, and they would talk about the mother, and they called it the horse's dam, or it would be dom properly. This was the mother, the bloodline through the mother. Bloodline or genetics, the genes carry instructions for both the physical family attributes and also the mental disposition, which is the inherent temperament and behavior. The components and kingdoms in our blood, if pure and disease-free, actually help turn on and off the genetic switches that protect the genetic line from damage and keep it working, keep it pure. Look up epigenetics. There are the physical traits and the mental traits that are passed on. Following reference shows the genetic component and the future prophetic character component that will be in mankind. Well, that will be in mankind. Next slide. Part of it's cut off. A dissertation on the Hebrew roots, intended to point out their extensive influence on all known languages, by Alex Peary. He says, Yahweh called the progenitor of the human race Adam, or Adam, and the reason of it, or the idea it conveys, because he was made, kadamot, according to the divine likeness. The root of this word, dama, likeness, or the image of anything. The image of anything. This is the pattern of physical and mental characteristics. And notice part two. And Adam, with an aleph, which is the first letter of the future, means I will make in my image or resemblance. This is the future pattern of perfect character, or tamim, we covered before. And he notes that the ground of which he was made was called Adama. This ties together with what Deacon Michael Ossoff brought last week, if you recall, in the matrix about bloodline, a pastor where it showed Yosef and Miriam with Maggie and descendant all connected. Genesis 5:1-2. This is account of the beginnings, the genetic line of Adam, Adam. In a day that Yahweh created man, Adam, he made them in the likeness, badamot, of Yahweh. He created them male and female and blessed them and named them mankind. The Hebrew word is Adam. In the day they were created. The word likeness, according to a manual Hebrew and English lexicon by Josiah Gibbs, says it means an image, a likeness, a model, pattern, copy, like, as. Remember, this word Adam describes both the physical and mental characteristics. It also shows the future prophetic mental likeness or character that mankind was ultimately created to have. The same pattern is copied. The bloodline is transferred from generation to generation. The end result of mankind's finishing work through the work of two sons of men, Adam. Yeshua, our high priest, and Israel Hawkins, our great priest. A house of people, end result is a house of people made physically to look like Yahweh will also become like Yahweh, perfect in character. Perfect in character. It was planned from the beginning. From the beginning. Notice Adam, mankind, is created from the dust of the ground, Adamah. And what is Adamah? It's red dirt. Genesis 2:7. And Yahweh formed man, Adam, of the dust, Adam, from the dust of the ground, Adamah. According to a Hebrew and Chaldee dictionary by James Strong, Adamah means, it's from the 119, which means soil from its general redness, earth, ground. Robertson's Compendious Hebrew Dictionary by Nahum Joseph says Adamah, the earth, properly the red earth. A Hebrew and English Lexicon Without Points by Parkhurst mentions that an ancient writer, Josephus by name, says Adamah is reddish earth. True virgin earth is of this color, he says. Next slide. This is an interesting article from the Oklahoman, News OK, Oklahoma City News. I'm going to read selected parts of it. It's too long. Driving deep into the central Oklahoma countryside with veteran Oklahoman photographer Steve Sisney, I looked out the windows at the landscape, an amalgamation of sky, field, and cattle. Twisted dead trees, the wreckage of a home, and the rusting shell of a car flashed by, remnants of a tornado that had raked Grady County several months earlier. All of it sat atop a striking element, the red Oklahoma earth. Wow, look at that, I said. What? Sisney replied. The dirt, it's so red, I've never seen anything like it. Next slide. The soil of central Oklahoma, that red earth, is our first piece in this series. It's actually a series. I know I'm not the only new arrival to be hypnotized by the red dirt, he says. He says, Edna May Arnold, whose grandfather in 1893 rushed into the Cherokee Strip, the largest in a series of 1890s Oklahoma land runs, Arnold recalled her own family's arrival in the state from Minnesota in 1914. The soil in Minnesota is black and was red in Oklahoma, and the whole family was fascinated by the red dirt, she recalled. The bright red soil characteristic of Oklahoma has a name, port. First recognized by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1942, the port series of soil is the state's most common and can be found in 33 of 77 counties, covering about 1 million acres in central and western Oklahoma, according to the U.S. Agriculture Department. In 1987, Oklahoma lawmakers named port silt loam the state's soil. It was so incredible. Next, we have a clip. It's from Cheyenne Chief Gordon Yellowman, an educator and peacemaker. He explains the deeper meaning of the red people and the red earth. May I play my clip, please?
Oklahoma is a word by the Choctaw that means red. Red, home of the red man, the red lands. You know, Oklahoma is really kind of basically referring to what the story you're talking about. Home of the red man.
Now, tell me more about the significance of the earth in the red earth and red dirt to Cheyenne and Arapaho cultures, as well as some other native cultures who, like your people, were forcibly removed to Oklahoma.
Well, again, from when we were forcibly removed here from our original homelands, no matter where we were, we always adapted those harsh conditions, but we lived in harmony with the environment. And one of the very first things that we learned to adapt was the lands. We learn to cultivate. We learn to preserve. We learn to protect. And through that connection with that earth, it was our people that made that connection. And when I mean by our people, I mean the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Plains tribes that were in those areas. And the lands, wherever we go, the land is always going to be seen through our eyes as red earth. And no matter where we go, when we converge, when we come together as nations, that land underneath our feet, that soil, is going to be connected with us because of the redness, the blood of our people, the blood of many nations.
Notice he said, preserve and protect. These native peoples had remnants of some of the knowledge of the ways of Yahweh. It's been brought up before, they used Yahweh's name. And they knew this land, this soil, this people had to be preserved and protected. That's guard and keep, right? We are put together from Yahweh's instructions to the microbugs. They bring healing to our bodies, and we are to guard and keep them in all this great creation of Yahweh. The microorganisms in the red earth, the red dirt, which mankind was created from, put together the man, and they have been known throughout history to guard those of certain bloodlines. It may seem like science fiction and unbelievable, but when we understand the micro kingdoms, it all makes sense. It's quite incredible, actually. Consider the following. Next slide. Number 16, 30 through 32. But if Yahweh creates a new thing in the earth, Adam, our red dirt, opens its mouth and swallows them up. The ground, Adam, our red dirt, split apart underneath them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up. Genesis 4, 10 through 11. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. You are cursed from the earth. The soil shall no longer yield its strength to you. Those who do violence, those who murder or break the other laws of Yahweh, will not receive the help from these bugs. They will not hear them. They will utterly reject those people. Leviticus 20, 22. You must therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments, and perform and do them, so that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. Leviticus 18, 26 through 28, we'll read just 28. Or the land will vomit you out if you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. Next slide. The 10th book of Israel, part 2, chapter 8, verse 75. They had Oklahoma runs. And then Yahweh sends dust. And he turns the whole thing into a dust bowl and drives them out. Praise Yahweh. Now you think about this. Think about his protection for the work in these last days. My next article is Farming in the 1930s, Red Dust from Oklahoma. The soil in northern Great Plains is black with rich organic material and humus that makes it a great medium for growing plants. And so you'd expect the dust in the air to be the same basic color, black or gray. But in the 1930s, people all over the country saw red dust blanketing their homes, towns, and farms. Millie Opitz remembers the red dust rolling in. She learned later that it came from Oklahoma. Next slide. 9th book of Israel, part 2, chapter 16, verses 14 through 17. Yahweh was cleansing this country and getting ready for myself, taking people out of the country, driving them out. I think this was Yahweh encouraging certain people to go that he didn't want around the Hawkins family at that time, praise Yahweh. And he swept Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. And Oklahoma sat right in the middle. And of course, but it went three states wide. And in verse 17, the outline part, a sky of red dirt and dust, he said. Revelation 12:16, and the earth helped the woman. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood. The earth helping the woman? How many times throughout history the bugs in the earth helped the woman and protected the seed? We don't know. We do know that a woman called Maggie and her husband Od were protected along with their seed, two of whom would stand with Yahweh. One of these is still with us today, and he established, according to the lot, a great work that is bringing in everlasting righteousness, protected by Yahweh through the red dirt, the Adamah, Strong's 127 from 119. In the ends, Hebrew Gematria 119, Keats, ends, of the earth. Who would have thought? Yahweh will protect his house. The 12th book of Israel, part 1, chapter 20, verse 83, authority was set that this woman would be taken to a certain place. That word nourish means to teach, meaning to teach, train, to educate. So this woman is prepared by the first work of the house of Yahweh. And this is still in this mind, the character and so forth for a woman. A woman to be taken to a wilderness, the wilderness of Oklahoma. Now another fascinating thing about our pastor Israel Hawkins, a priest of Yahweh, as it says in Zechariah 6:13, being called an Okie from Oklahoma, is that Oklahoma is the 46th state. And in Hebrew gematria, 46 is another interesting word. Next slide. 46 is Lewi, or Levi, as we say today. Oklahoma and Oki refers to Levi, meaning one attached, joined, tethered to the priesthood. A special land, a protected, set-apart land, prepared for a certain family of the end generation. Now we're going to move on to Purcell, which will bring us back to where we started. Wikipedia, the land run. It says, Oklahoma, Congress finally agreed to open what was dubbed the unassigned land. Seven land runs all took place in Oklahoma. I thought that was interesting, seven. Beginning with the initial and most famous land rush of April 22nd, 1889. Again, according to Wikipedia, about on McLean County, Oklahoma, McLean County is a county located in south central Oklahoma. Its county seat is Purcell. History. Purcell was a starting point for the land run of 1889. It was also at the dividing line between Indian Territory and Oklahoma Territory. Next slide. So I looked up the Hebrew for Purcell. The first part of Purcell, Pur. A Hebrew and English lexicon of the Old Testament based on the lexicon of William Gesenius, translated by Edward Robinson, edited by Brown Driver Briggs. Pur. Lot. Stone. And it says in the bottom of the reference, explained by Hagorel using Esther 3:7, which is Hadassah 3:7. It says in Hadassah 3:7, they cast the pur, that is the lot. The word lot here is the Hebrew word gorel, according to a Hebrew and English lexicon of the Old Testament based on the lexicon of William Gesenius, translated by Edward Robinson, a different version than the book above. Gorel, stone, as used in casting lots. The word pur is a Babylonian, Middle Persian word, which was used during the Babylonian captivity. It was used in a Babylonish, weak, lawless land, pur. The scripture says Pur was a Gorel, the lot stone. The last part of Purcell, Sel, Hebraic tongue restored, Sel, every kind of movement which raises, exalts. Also a Hebrew and English lexicon of the Old Testament, based on the lexicons of William Gesenius, translated by Edward Robinson. Sel, lift up, cast up, esteem highly, loftiness, distinction. Purcell is referring to a lifted up lot stone. It's pointing to a work that starts in that red land, a set-aside land for the priesthood, the protected and guarded land where a woman was taken into the wilderness of Oklahoma, where the two witnesses were raised. These two brought forth two women, the last two heirs of the house of Yahweh, in a Babylonish land, it says in Zechariah 5, 9 through 11. For your notes, the following scriptures talk about these two men who stand for Yahweh and stand with Yahweh. Zechariah 4, 14, Daniel 12, 5, Isaiah 48, 12 through 13, and Revelation 11, 4. This word stand in the Hebrew is very peculiar. When I think of the word stand, I think of when I worked in a computer department for a large company. We'd set up a new office. We'd have the legal department, get the building, follow all the paperwork to set up the office till it was a recognized entity. Next, we'd bring in the equipment. We'd set up the servers and computers. The programming had to be exactly right. You got all the wiring, all the connections in place. When all the equipment and the infrastructure was set in order, then the workers were chosen and put in their assigned areas in this office. It was called the standing up of an office. It meant to get it ready, to establish it and put it in working order. You needed to have a couple people who knew what they were doing or there would be no office. Next slide. This word stand, Emmanuel Hebrew and English lexicon according to the Biblical Chaldee by Josiah Gibbs, means stand, establish, confirm, appoint to an office, ordain, establish. The Hebrew word stand is the word amad. It also means lift up, to appoint to an office, to a minister, to establish. Here in the scripture is speaking of authorizing and appointing two men to do a work. The standing up of a work, the establishing, dedicating, and setting out in order a work called the house of Yahweh, that these two men were given a part. The word stand or stood in Zechariah 4:14 and Daniel 12:1 and 13 links to the word establish in Isaiah 2:2 and Micaiah 4:1. It shows who is doing the work. The one who is like Yahweh is left standing, who established the house of Yahweh in the United States. It had to be done by one like Yahweh or it would not have been done. It would not be a finishing work. He is the priest working with Yeshua to build the house of Yahweh. He is the end generation, the time personified. It's the time period of a certain man when knowledge will be increased in his generation, a time when knowledge of the horrific weaponry, computers, and the pinnacle of sin, the evil of the gods, has come into being, somehow compressed into a narrow time slot, a sliver of time. Never before mankind had such ability to destroy. Never before has such a work come forth, a work that is bringing forth teachers to eventually bring peace to the universe. Remember, it was sealed to the time of the end. This time period called end is when Yeshua opens the seals and reveals all to the man called witness. Let's go back to Daniel 12. I'm closing. At that time in Daniel 12:1, one who is like Yahweh will stand up. It says in verse 4, "But you, O Daniel, shut up the word, seal the book to the time of the end. Many will run to and fro, and knowledge will be increased." It says, verse 5, "Behold, there stood two others." But he said in verse 9, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. But you go your way until the end, for you will rest and stand in your lot at the end of days." I want you to notice something here. In verse 9, Daniel is told to go his way. There's no reason to tell him this again. Verse 13 is referring to someone else. It's referring to the one who is like Yahweh, the same one who stands in verse 1, our pastor Israel Hawkins. He is told to go his way until the end, and he would do his work and stand in his lot in this end time period, the end days from the ends of the earth, 119. You shall stand in your lot actually means set up a work, establish, set in order according to your lot. The Hebrew word for lot in the scripture is the word gorel, and is prefixed to the Hebrew letter lamed, which can be translated as according to, as, or like, according to online Bible Hebrew text and Hebrew and English lexicon without points. Israel Hawkins was given the white lot stone by Yeshua, our high priest, a commission to do this work. He was prophesied to stand up a work according to the lot. These prophecies have come to pass. The Hebrew of the end of Daniel 12:13 can be translated, "You shall stand up a work, establish according to your lot at the end time." It sounds like a command to someone, an encouragement for him maybe, right? You witness, you branch, you are going to do it. You are sent to perform all of Yahweh's will. He is going to do it. He is doing it. Does it sound like a prophecy? Well, if it is, do we all believe all that the prophets have spoken? The lot says it all. That's the end of my portion. I'd like to turn over to next speaker, the great Kahan, David Heimerman Hawkins. Please stand. May Yahweh bless your understanding.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. It's an honor and a privilege to address the called out ones of the house of Yahweh. You all may be seated. Get part of my technology up here on the podium so I have access to it. It's an honor and a privilege to address the called out ones of the house of Yahweh today, both you here sitting in the sanctuary of the house of Yahweh and all the world that's being called at this time, who have the opportunity to access the sermons through the technology that Daniel spoke about. The title of the sermon today is the last 3.5 years, the 10 kings will give their power and authority to the beast for 1 hour. And today's date, Yeshua 13. I'd like to begin today in Revelation chapter 13 and begin in verse 1. Okay. Revelation 13, verse 1, and Yeshua, inspired to be written here, he said, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea. And, of course, sea means people, the population of the earth, if you will, having 7 heads. And this is a description defined in the book of Revelation chapter 17. We see that this is a place. It's the 10 hills of Rome. And the 10 horns, these are religious powers. This is a note from the book of Yahweh. And upon his horns, 10 crowns. These are kings. We're going to see that these are kings. In fact, in 2016, the house of Yahweh revealed who these kings were. The pastor spoke, I think it was in the seventh Roman month of 2016, and showed the picture of the 10 kings, and we're going to see that again here today. And upon his heads, the names of blasphemy. This blasphemy is the changing of Yahweh's laws, the changing of Yahweh's laws to the laws of the gods you see in the earth today. But this description here in verse 1 is the current status of the Vatican. The Vatican on the 7 hills of Rome with the religious 10 religions that have pledged their allegiance to the Pope. Now, verse 2, and the beast which you saw was similar to a leopard. And we're going to see in Daniel chapter 7 that this is speaking of the Greek Empire, the leopard. And his feet were as the feet of a bear. And this is speaking of the Medes and the Persians, that empire. And his mouth as the mouth of a lion. This is the Babylonian Empire that Daniel served. And the dragon, Satan, gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So in Daniel chapter 7 now, we're going to cover most of the verses in Daniel chapter 7. So in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel had a vision, a dream. And in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions in his mind as he lay upon his bed. Then he wrote down his dream, beginning the account of this matter. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven broke out upon the great sea. Now, these four winds that Daniel saw are these four great ruling empires, the Babylonians. And these came in this order. Pastor referred to these four kingdoms as the quartet. These first was the Babylonians, then the Medes and the Persians, then the Greek Empire, and then the Romans. And today's is a continuation of this Roman system. And the great sea, that's defined in Revelation 17, verse 15. And he said to me, the waters which you saw were the whore, the Vatican, the Holy Sea. The Holy Sea is the sovereign nation of the Vatican. Sits are peoples, multitudes, nations and languages. Verse 3 of Daniel 7. The four great beasts, this is Daniel's vision now, the four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the others. The first was like a lion. And that was Babylon, and had eagle's wings. I beheld until its wings were plucked up, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon its feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. This is the kingdom of Babylon. And behold, another beast, the second, that was like a bear, and this was the Medes and the Persians, and it raised itself up on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth. Now, this three ribs, in the mark of the beast, when you come to the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, it'll show you that there were three kingdoms that came before it, the Egyptian, the Assyrian, and the Babylonian. So I believe that's what these three ribs are between its teeth. And they said this to it, arise, devour much flesh. Verse 6, and this I beheld, and lo, another, the third beast, like a leopard, and this was the Greeks, which had four wings like a fowl upon its back. This beast also had four heads. Now, Alexander the Great became the king of Greece at the age of 20, when his father, who was a king, was assassinated. And Alexander ruled Greece for 12 years. He basically conquered every nation in the known world at that time with his mighty army, never lost a fight. But at the age of 32, he died. Some say he was assassinated himself with poison. But his kingdom went to four generals. It was divided into four parts, and the Greek Empire went to four different parts, each with a general. So four generals who succeeded Alexander the Great, and it was given great authority to rule. Actually, let me read verse 7 here. After this I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast. And this is the one that concerned Daniel. Dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong, and it had great iron teeth and devoured and broke to pieces. This was the Romans, the Roman Empire. Then trampled the residue with its feet. It was different from the other beast, and there were before it, and it had 10 horns. And these are religious powers, religious organizations. 10 horns were part of this empire. So to summarize what Daniel saw, first of all, in Daniel chapter 2, he had interpreted the dream, the vision that King Nebuchadnezzar had, and that was in Daniel chapter 2. And then now we're reading in Daniel chapter 7, where he had this dream and vision himself, seeing in both cases, in both chapters, the same four empires. And to summarize them, the first kingdom was the Babylonians from 626 to 529 BY before Yahshua. In Daniel chapter 2, it was described as the head of fine gold. And in Daniel chapter 7, the first was like a lion. And so the second kingdom then, the Medes and the Persians from 550 to about 359 BY, described as the breast and arms of silver. The second, like a bear, this kingdom. The third kingdom, the Greeks, from 359 to 168 BY, described as the stomach and thighs of bronze, and another, third beast, like a leopard. And these characteristics, the lion, the bear, and the leopard, they were all described in this beast that we see in Revelation 13:1, because they're all part of this system today. Bits and pieces of them are. And then the great image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw in Daniel 2 and the dream that Daniel had in chapter 7, the fourth kingdom, the Romans, 168 to the present. The military part of this kingdom no longer exists, but the religious part is the ruler of the kings of the earth today. It was described as the legs of iron and the feet part iron and part clay. And a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke to pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, the Roman legions. They were a mighty, very powerful army. So in Daniel chapter 7, verse 7, after this, Daniel says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and exceedingly strong, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured, broke to pieces. This was the Romans. Then trampled the residue with his feet. And notice also, it was different from the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns, 10 religions. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn. This is a religious power that came up, and is today the Roman Catholic Church, called the Vatican, or the international country of the called the Holy See, before whom there were three of these first horns plucked up by the roots. And we're going to see more about this, who these three horns were, and how they were plucked up by their roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man. They are a man. It is a man being described here. In fact, the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. And a man speaking great things. So now from the 14th book of Yisrael, chapter 15, verse 150, Pastor is going to tell us who these three horns are. And he says here, I know that the Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, I know that those three religions, they were religions. The Herodians, this is the fourth one, were army possessors and murderers. The Herodian house, they killed and took what they wanted to take with their army, and they took it from anywhere and everywhere they wanted to take it from. They were strong, wealthy people that plucked up the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes, and took them to Rome and established what we see now as the International Roman Catholic Church, guiding and leading the nations, still with the same armies undercover, secretly, of course, the mystery Babylon religion that's leading the world. Continuing from the books of Israel here, from the 15th book, chapter 23, but in Daniel 7, and we're reading out of Daniel 7 today, we see here this empire that was built on the seven hills of Rome. It was actually started in Israel. Yes, that's where they came from. These three religious powers came from Israel. And then the one that owned the Roman army plucked up three other religions and transplanted them. That's what Daniel shows in chapter 7. And from the 15th book of Yisrael, chapter 12, little horn. This the words from the book of Daniel here. Now, little horn, this little horn before them, before whom there were three of the first horns, religions plucked up by the roots. And that's exactly what you see in the second part of the book of Yahweh. The Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes were plucked up by the Herodians and taken to Rome. And from the 16th book of Yisrael, Pastor says, chapter 40, he says, yes, the Catholic Church was alive and well in Daniel's day. They changed their names from Coptic Catholic and hid it for a while and disguised themselves as Pharisees and Sadducees. They were also called Essenes. And the Herodians, who were the rich ones, the Rockefeller group who owned the army and stood on his part. The Herodians plucked up or transplanted. Think of pulling up a plant by its root or pulling up a plant by its roots and taking it to another part of the garden and transplanting it. Well, that's basically occurred here. They went from Jerusalem to Rome. The Herodians plucked up the other three of these and took them with them to Rome, the seven hills of Rome with their army. And that was, of course, in 70 AD when the temple in Jerusalem, the house of Yahweh in Jerusalem, was destroyed. Now in Daniel chapter 7, his vision continues here. He says, I beheld until the thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days, Yahweh, did sit. So this is at the very end of this plan here. This is what we're looking forward to that day. Whose vesture, and it describes Yahweh here, whose vesture was white as snow, and his hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. Continuing with the description of Yahweh's throne here, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands, thousands ministered to him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. So the entries we put in the books, it's all going to be revealed in that day. And I'm going to move on to the next one here. Daniel 7, verse 11. I beheld then, Daniel said, because of the voice of the great words, which the horn, and I've added in here, there have been 266 popes that have been in charge of the Catholic Church since its and, you know, some of these popes commanded the Crusades, and so they and brings us down to what we have today. Which the horn spoke, I beheld until the beast was slain. And this is speaking of the beast we read here in Revelation 13, verse 1. The beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. The burning flame, and that's that prophecy pertains to the ten kings, which we're going to get to here shortly. Verse 12, as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their governments taken away. Yes, they did. These four kingdoms we saw, the Babylonians, the Medes, the Persians, the Greeks, the Roman military power, they had their governments taken away. But notice, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. The remnants from these empires are part of this system that we see in the world today, this system that's against Yahweh's law. Their culture is part of this God-worshipping system that is in opposition to Yahweh today. Verse 13, I saw in the night vision, behold, one like the Son of Man, speaking of Yahshua, come with the clouds in heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, Yahweh, and they, speaking of the 144,000, speaking of the resurrection, it's speaking of us, those who will be changed at this time period, and they were brought together before him. In verse 14 of Daniel 7, and there was given him Yahshua, ruling authority and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should obey him. His government is everlasting. It's eternal. Eternal salvation. That's what's being spoken of here. An eternal kingdom, not the temporary kingdoms you see in the earth today. This is an everlasting kingdom. His government is an everlasting government which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not ever be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions that passed through my mind troubled me. But now, Daniel, he was troubled by his visions, but now he's going to get an explanation of what this all meant. And he's going to receive an explanation from Yahweh's last day's witness, Israel Hawkins, who is living in this generation when all this history is known and Yahweh's laws are being taught, his prophecies are being taught in the earth today through the house of Yahweh, through his last day's witness, Israel Hawkins. So in Daniel 7, verse 16, he said, I came near to one, Israel Hawkins, of those two witnesses, and these are the same ones spoken of in Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 12, one on this side of the river and the other on the other side of the bank of the river. The man clothed in linen, that's who Daniel's speaking to here, who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and revealed the interpretation of these things to me. These great beasts, which are four kings, which will arise out of the earth. But the saints of Yahweh, I'd like to just back up here for a moment. Okay, so the picture there, Yahweh's last day's witness, Yisro Hawkins in the center, and his brother, Jacob, up in the upper right-hand corner. This is from the 2011 Prophetic Word magazine. So in verse 18, but the saints of Yahweh will take the kingdom by force. Pastor said in a long time ago in a sermon, he said, when Yahshua comes, he's not going to be a weak ruler. When he returns, he's going to come with the authority to set things in order, to establish Yahweh's kingdom. So, but the saints of Yahweh will take the kingdom by force and will possess the kingdoms forever, yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know, Daniel said here, then I would know the truth of the fourth beast. What about this fourth beast, the dreadful and terrible one, that was different from the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his claws of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. And he also wanted to know, and the ten horns that were on his head, and of the other horn that came up, before whom three fell, or the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout, more mighty, imposing than his fellows. And verse 21, I beheld the same horn, speaking of the Vatican, made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Now this is a historical event. This verse 21, you can read all about it in the book, The Lost Faith of the Apostles and Prophets. It will describe what Pastor is explaining to Daniel here, and what Daniel saw in his vision, that the apostles from Yeshua's time, the first five heirs of the house of Yahweh, they were killed out basically through false doctrine creeping in, and through persecution by this beastly system here this horn that's being spoken of here. So I beheld the same horn, the Vatican, made war with the saints for the first 300 years after Yeshua and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came. And you know, part of this persecution was the changing of the laws by Constantine in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, changing the Sabbath to The first 300 years, they kept the Sabbath, but it was changed to Sunday worship, the first day of the week instead of the seventh day. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of Yahweh, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. So Daniel 23, this is what he, Yisro Hawkins, said. He said, the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, will be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which will be different from the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, have influence over the entire earth. The Vatican today, the leader of the kings of the earth, they've got just a very small group of security people themselves, but they have control over NATO. They have control of the vast armies of the earth today. That's their army, the Pope's army. Pastors referred to NATO as the Pope's army. And will devour the whole earth and will tread it down and break it to pieces. There are approximately 1.2 billion people in the Roman Catholic Church today. And so that's a lot of power and authority in the earth today. And the ten kings out of this kingdom are, and the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that will arise, and another will rise after them, and he will be different from the first ones, and he will subdue kings, three kings, and these are the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. he will speak great words against Yahweh and will wear out, mentally attack to cause to fall away the saints of Yahweh and think to change Yahweh's change times. And this is the changing of the Sabbath to first day worship, changing of Yahweh's feast days to the worldly holidays. This is what's being spoken of here. And he will change Yahweh's feast days and laws, and they will be given into his hand until this present time, a time, times, and the dividing of time, this very present time that we're living in right now. But judgment will sit, and they will take away his government to consume and destroy it completely. It's going to be completely taken over, as it says, consume and destroy it completely. Then the kingdoms and governments and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of Yahweh, whose kingdom, again, is an everlasting kingdom. It's not temporary. It's not temporary like we see today in the world. And all governments will serve and obey Yahweh. Here the account, Daniel says, here the account is concluded. And Daniel was troubled by this. He was troubled by everything he saw. The description of these beastly systems, and it troubled him greatly. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations, mental thoughts deeply troubled me, and my cheerful mental attitude changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. So now let's go to Revelation chapter 17, which talks about the Vatican. It talks about the ten kings. And here in Revelation 17, verse 1, and there came one of the seven Malachim who had the seven bowls. Now, there's only one of these seven Malachim that are described in Revelation that has done any teaching in this generation, and that is Yahweh's last witness, Yisrael Hawkins. The five of these eras were wiped out by the by 325 AY, and the witness Jacob, who established the house of Yahweh with the witness Yisrael Hawkins, his light went out in 1991, 322 of 91. So, and there came one of the seven Malachim who had the seven bowls and talked with me, saying to me, come, I, Yisrael Hawkins, the seventh Malach, will show you the sentence of the great whore that sits upon many waters. And the seventh Malach said to me, why are you astonished? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and ten horns. This is the seven heads, the seven hills of Rome. It gives a location of this organization. And the ten horns, these are religious powers. So in Revelation 17 here, 9, 10, and 11, the incredible thing about these three verses is that it describes the kings, the popes, of the Roman Catholic Church. This is the Western Church, the one taken from Jerusalem to Rome. This was referred to as the Western Church. Latin was their language, Latin. And this was one of the things that separated them from the Eastern churches, which they spoke Greek, and they were in the East. But anyway, this description here of 9, 10, and 11 describes the Catholic Church, the Vatican, during the generation of the witnesses. During this generation, this is specifically for this generation. And here is the mind which our generation, and here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven hills are seven mountains, the seven hills of Rome, on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings, five, and these kings are popes. Spoken of here, these are popes of the Roman Catholic Church. Five popes have fallen since the Lateran Treaty of 1929. And what's significant about this Lateran Treaty of 1929, the Vatican received international recognition at that time. The Holy See is the name of the country of the Vatican. And so this, they got this right agreement in 1929 with the Lateran Treaty. They got their, some of their property back that the Italian government had taken from them in 1870. They finally got it back, and it defines what modern Rome, modern Catholic Church is today. 110 acres, the buildings, the properties. They got money, compensation for their property being taken over in other parts of Italy by the Roman government. And they got this international status. And they were also considered the only recognized religion in Italy at the time. I think that's changed a little bit since then. But this is defining this present generation. Jacob, the witness Jacob, born in 1926. The witness Yisrael Hawkins, born in 1934. And the Lateran Treaty, giving the Vatican these rights and what they are today, in 1929, so right in between the birth of the two witnesses. And these seven kings, five, and there are seven kings. Five, these are popes, have fallen since the Lateran Treaty of 1929, and one is. So, I mean, this snapshot, this one is, this is two incredible words defining the time period when the House of Yahweh would be established in the chief of the nations. So this number six, John Paul II, he became pope in 1978. The House of Yahweh established in 1981, in the early 1980s. But three and Satan didn't want, the dragon didn't want this prophecy to be fulfilled. She sent an assassin to try to kill John Paul II 2 months before the House of Yahweh received recognition from the state of Texas as a religious organization. So, and there are seven kings, five popes have fallen, five had died by the time John Paul came on the scene since the Lateran Treaty of 1929, and one is, this is John Paul II, the sixth king. And the other, the seventh king, has not yet come. And this was Benedict. And his only contribution to the mess they have today is that he forbid, or he took the name Yahweh out of the Catholic songbooks. That Yahweh was in some of the Catholic songbooks, and Benedict's contribution was to say, take it out. So he came, must come for a short time. He shortened his own time by resigning after 7 years. And now we're up to the present Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, Francis, and the beast that was and is not, indeed he, Pope Francis, is the eighth and final king in this generation. And he is of the seven and is going into perdition. Now that word perdition, it means ruination. It means destruction. That's the end result of the system here that speaks. He's going to go into perdition. Now in Revelation 17, verse 12, the next verse here, and the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which as yet have not received the kingdom. No, they were independent up until this time, but receive authority as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now, let's talk about these ten kings that the House of Yahweh pastor revealed in 2016, in the seventh Roman month of 2016. It says the Eastern Orthodox Church, officially the Orthodox Catholic Church, is the second largest Christian church. It operates as the largest one is the Roman Catholic Church. This is the Eastern Orthodox Church. It operates as a communium or a group of autocephalous churches, each governed by its bishops, called a holy synod. The church has no central doctrinal governance authority. So, no kingdom, in other words. They're independents, 10 independent religions, all believing the same thing, but no central doctrinal governance authority. The word autocephalous describes that, independent of external and especially patriarchal authority, used especially of the Eastern Orthodox churches. So this is a picture that was shown here in the House of Yahweh in the middle of 2016. And this picture came from a conference that these 10 kings got together and they pledged unity in 2016. This picture was taken on the island of Crete, 6/17 of 2016, and it was shown here in the sanctuary about a month later. So from Wikipedia here, the Eastern Orthodox Church, especially the Orthodox Catholic, officially the Orthodox Catholic Church, is the second largest Christian church with approximately 200 to 260 million members. As one of the oldest religious institutions in the world, in fact, started by the apostles, these Orthodox churches, they claim their start came from the apostles as small communities of believers, but after 300 years, under attack, they no longer were a community of believers. As one of the oldest religious organizations in the world, the Orthodox Church has played a prominent role in the history and culture of Eastern and Southeastern Europe, the Caucasus, which is a mountain range, and the Near East. Now, I've got the definition of the Caucasus here because when I read this, I remembered what Pastor has said about right around 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan. The House of Yahweh was in contact with some countries in this region here to promote the peaceful solution. And so and some of these countries here were in this Caucasus region. The Caucasus is a region of southeastern Europe, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and part of southern Russia in Europe, between the Black and Caspian Seas, divided by the Caucasus Mountains. So these people that were interested in the peaceful solution, many of them were probably Eastern Orthodox believers at that time. So continuing here from Wikipedia here, the Eastern Orthodox Church operates as a communium or a group of autocephalous independent churches, each governed by its bishops called the Holy Synod. The church has no central doctrinal or governance authority analogous or like the Catholic Pope, but the ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople is recognized by all as the primus inter pares, which means first among equals. It means he's their unofficial leader. He's their unofficial leader. They're all independent, but he's their unofficial leader of the bishops. But notice what Revelation 17:12 says. And the 10 horns, which you saw, are 10 kings, which as yet have not received the kingdom. They were independent, but receive authority as kings 1 hour, 1 hour with the beast. So I'd like to touch on this topic of 1 hour. How long is 1 hour? Well, you're going to say it's 60 minutes. Okay. Well, I'd like to use Yeshua's words to define what I believe this 1 hour is that's spoken of here. In Revelation 17, verse 12, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which as yet have not received a kingdom, but receive authority as kings 1 hour with the beast. So going to Yochanan chapter 2, this is described as Yeshua's first act of power, changing water to wine. So in Yochanan chapter 2, verse 1, now the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Yeshua was there. And both Yeshua and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Yeshua, who knew what he was capable of by this time, said to the mother of Yeshua, said to him, "They have no wine." And Yeshua said to her, "Woman, what does this concern of yours have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And what hour is he talking about? I'd like to try to explain that here with the next slide. But notice his mother had total confidence in his abilities here by this time. And she said, his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he, Yeshua, says to you, do it." So the length of time, my hour, that Yeshua was talking about here, because the kings are going to give their power to the beast for 1 hour. The length of time, my hour, of Yeshua's ministry. And I believe that Yeshua was talking about his time when he would be revealed as the Messiah. Through his teaching, through his works, he would be revealed to all Israel, to the priests, the Levites, and to all Israel as the Messiah. And that time period was about 3.5 years of his, what I would call his public ministry. And so it began. Yochanan introduces Yeshua, and this was in Yochanan 1, verses 29 through 33, four months before the first Passover. Yeshua, in his, what I would call his public ministry, he observed four Passovers during that time. But he was introduced 4 months before the first one. And when I say that 4 months, Yochanan was baptizing in Galilee. And so the priests and Levites sent people up there to find out what Yochanan was up to, and basically hear from Yochanan chapter 2, verse 29. The next day, Yochanan saw Yeshua coming toward him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of Yahweh who takes away the sin of the world. This is he whom I said," and he's speaking to the Pharisees and the representatives they sent from Jerusalem to find out what Yochanan was doing. "The one coming after me has become in front of me because he is my head. Now Yochanan continues here. He says, "Now I did not recognize him of myself, but that he should be revealed." That he should be revealed to you people who came here to find out what I was up to, thinking I was the Messiah, Yochanan says. "For that he should be revealed to Israel, in this reason is the reason I came baptizing with water." And Yochanan gave this testimony, saying, "I have perceived the Spirit descending from heaven, and it now rests upon him. Now I did not recognize him, but the one who sent me to baptize with water told me, on whom you may perceive this, the Spirit coming down and abiding in him, this is the one who will immerse with Spirit holy." So that's what I mean by he was introduced to the religious people in Jerusalem at this time. And then Yeshua taught for about three years, 4 months. And on the fourth Passover that he attended, he was the Passover lamb, according to the words spoken by the prophets. And then after that, he ministered another 40 days after his resurrection. So about 3.5 years. His hour was about 3.5 years. Total length of time of Yeshua's ministry, shown in the book of Yochanan, about 3.5 years. Now, this article came from the Golden Oil Book, published by the House of Yahweh in 2016, I believe, or 2017. But this article came from the Golden Oil Book, and it says the Orthodox Church has declared its unity. Notice they were independent churches, but now what did they do? They declared their unity. They came together as a kingdom, so to speak. During the June 20 to 26 Pan-Orthodox Council, the Orthodox Church has declared its unity in a message of the Pan-Orthodox Council which took place in Crete on June 26, 2016, the key priority of the council was to proclaim the unity, to become a kingdom, come together in a little kingdom and give their authority to the beast. Proclaim the unity of the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox autocephalous churches do not constitute a federation of churches, now this their statement reads, but one holy Catholic and apostolic church, the message reads. The council was convened after 50 years of preparation. 50 years ago, when Yisrael Hawkins, when Yahweh was moving, inspiring Yahweh's Last Days Witness to come to Abilene to begin his work of establishing the house of Yahweh, about that very same time, a different spirit, a lying spirit, was putting it into the minds of these Orthodox church leaders that they should be in unity, come to unity with the Roman Church. The council convened after over 50 years of preparation. 50 years they worked on this. And of the 14 national Orthodox churches, four did not attend. See how perfect Yahweh is? He said there'd be 10, and that's what was there. And those who didn't attend, the Patriarch of Russia, Georgia, Bulgarian Orthodox churches, as well as the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Antioch and all the East. Those four did not attend. Revelation 17, verse 17. But Yahweh has put it in the ten kings' hearts to perform his will and to agree and give their kingdom to the beast until the words, prophecies of Yahweh will be fulfilled. How was this accomplished? How did this come to pass? I have a little story here for the children. And children, Pastor has told us how his mother would read the Holy Scriptures to him. All the children would gather on the table when all the work was done in the evening. And they would read from the Holy Scriptures, from the Book of Yahweh, even though it wasn't called the Book of Yahweh then, it was called the King James Version. But they would read the Scriptures, the inspired Word of Yahweh. And so I want you children, as I read this story, I want you to think about how Yahweh's prophet Micaiah stood up against 400 prophets of the Lord. I want you to, and this is an interesting story of how Yahweh brought to pass, or how the will of Yahweh came to pass. Now, I'll give you a little, to answer how the ten kings came to this point. Just a little clue here in 1 Kings 22:23. Behold, Yahweh has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets, advisors of yours, you ten kings. Yahweh has spoken disaster against you, the beast from the sea. So, now, I want, first of all, from the 16th book of Yisrael, Pastor says, he says, there's a misprint in Revelation 17:17, where it says, Yahweh put it in their hearts to perform his will. That's a mistranslation. The correct way, I'll just read the correct translation. But it came to pass that it was in their hearts to perform their will. Yahweh didn't put it in their hearts. The Vatican put it in their hearts. The leader of the kings, even the ten kings, are being led by the Vatican, and they don't realize it. They're going to wake up to the fact that the Vatican has more power than they, and they don't really have the authority that they thought that was given to them. This is where they're going to turn in hatred against the Vatican itself and wipe it out. So, this is the story that I'm sure Pastor heard from his mother read out of the book of the scriptures. But in 1 Kings 22:2, then in the third year, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went down to see the king of Israel, Ahab. So he, Ahab, presented this question to Jehoshaphat: "Will you go with me to fight at Ramoth Gilead?" Ahab had lost territory to the Arameans, and they had taken over Ramoth Gilead, and he wanted to get his property back. Then Jehoshaphat, the king of Israel, said to the king of Israel, he gave him a tentative yes. He said, but inquire this day for counsel and advice of Yahweh. Jehoshaphat still worshiped Yahweh. Ahab did not. So the king of Israel, Ahab, assembled together the prophets, about 400 men, and asked them, shall I go up to war at Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain? And they all answered him, go up, Adonai, my Lord, will deliver it into the hands of the king. But Jehoshaphat asked, is there no longer a prophet of Yahweh here, so we may inquire of him? Children, you see the difference? Jehoshaphat was asking, well, I want the advice of a prophet of Yahweh, someone who worships Yahweh, not someone who worships the gods. So the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, there remains one man, just like in these last days, one man, Yisrael Hawkins, who is standing in his place. There remains one man by whom we may inquire of Yahweh, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything great about me, only evil. Micaiah, who is like Yahweh, son of Imeah. Then Jehoshaphat said, the king should not say such things. Then the king of Israel summoned an official, says, bring Micaiah, son of Imeah, at once. The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, had dressed themselves in their robes and were sitting on their thrones at the threshing floor by the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied in front of them. I have a picture of this, but not really. It's a picture, but it is a picture, a modern-day picture, of Bartholomew and Francis with their 400 prophets of Baal. I can show you that in just a moment. And all the prophets prophesied in front of them, and the rest of the prophets prophesied the same thing. Go up to Gilead and conquer. Yahweh will deliver it into the hands of the king. But Micaiah said, as surely as Yahweh lives, I can. This is Micaiah, the prophet of Yahweh, speaking now, children. He says, I can only speak as Yahweh tells me. So he, Micaiah, answered, I saw all of Israel scattered upon the hills like sheep without a shepherd. And Yahweh said, they have no leader. So what occurred to Ahab? Did something occur to Ahab here that they have no king anymore? Let each one of these return to his home in peace. The king of Israel, Ahab, then said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you he would prophesy nothing great about me, but only evil? Micaiah continued, hear the word of Yahweh. I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing around him, and on his right hand and on his left. Then Yahweh said, who will entice Ahab to go up so he may fall? So he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead. One gave this suggestion, and another suggested that. Then a spirit came forth and stood in front of Yahweh and said, I will lure him. So Yahweh asked her, how will you do this? She replied, I will go out, and I will be a lying spirit in the mouths of all his prophets. And Yahweh said, you will entice him, and you will succeed in luring him. Go and do it. Behold, Yahweh has put, this is Micaiah's words to Ahab here now, behold, Yahweh has put a lying spirit in the mouths of all these prophets of yours. Yahweh has spoken disaster against you, Ahab. So how did this conclude? Well, the two kings went up to battle at Ramoth-Gilead. And of course, Ahab, he said to the king of to Jehoshaphat, you wear your kingly robes, and I'll dress up as a common soldier here so they don't recognize me. But then here in verse 34, but someone, one of the enemy, the Arameans, drew his bow at random, and an arrow struck the king of Israel, Ahab, between the sections of his armor. In other words, he was wounded. He ordered the driver of his chariot, turn around, carry me out of the fighting because I am wounded. The battle raged throughout the day while the king was propped up in his chariot facing the Arameans. The blood poured from his wound onto the floor of the chariot, and that evening he died. In verse 38, just as the word of Yahweh had spoken. So I promised you a picture of these two men with their 400 lying prophets. This is Pope Francis and the Patriarch Bartholomew meeting with counselors and advisors. That's Bartholomew on the right, giving a hug to Pope Francis there. They're hugging each other. So this is part of their coming together, and Bartholomew pledging the support of these 10 kings to Francis. Now, this is a message of Pope Francis, His Holiness to Bartholomew, on the occasion of the Feast of St. Andrew, patron saint of the Ecumenical Patriarch. And this was in 2017, toward the end of 2017. And this is what Francis wrote to Bartholomew. He said, "It is a source of joy to learn on the eve of the Feast of St. Andrew, during a meeting attended by Your Holiness, notice, the 50th anniversary of the visit of Pope Paul VI to the Fanar, which is the residence in Constantinople of Bartholomew, on the 25th day of 1967, the same year that Yahweh's Spirit Holy inspired Pastor to come to Abilene to begin the work of the house of Yahweh. So these lying spirits were at work convincing these men to get together in unity. And this was a unification effort that was started in 1967 and even a couple of years before that. That historic moment of communion between the pastors of the Church of Rome in the West, the Latin Church, and the Church of Constantinople in the East, the Greek Church, brings to mind the words of Patriarch Antithagonus in welcoming Pope Paul VI to the Patriarchal Church of St. George, where you are gathered today. I believe that these words can continue to inspire the dialogue between our churches." So Francis's message to Bartholomew continues. He said, "Let us join together what was divided," just as the book of Revelation says would be done, wherever this is possible by deeds in which both churches are involved, giving added strength. The 10 kings are giving their power and authority to Francis, giving added strength to the matters of faith and canonical discipline which we have in common. So in Revelation 17, verse 12, "And the 10 kings which you saw are 10 kings which have not received a kingdom, but receive authority as kings 1 hour," I believe that's about 3.5 years, about 3.5 years. "These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority, giving added strength to the beast." 1.2 billion Catholic members being joined by another approximately 250 million people, and the nations that they represent. So the message of Pope Francis to His Holiness Bartholomew, "Let us join together that which was divided, wherever this is possible, by deeds in which both churches are involved, giving added strength to matters of faith and canonical discipline." So Revelation 17, verse 14, "These 10 kings and the beast will make war with the Lamb, Yahshua, but the Lamb will overcome them, for He is ruler of rulers and King of kings, and those who are with Him are called and chosen and faithful. And the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these will hate the whore and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh," and notice, "burn her with fire." Revelation 17:14. What did Daniel chapter 7 verse 11 say? I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld until the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to what? The burning flame. So here once again is the picture of the ten kings taken in the middle of 2016 on the island of Crete, where they came together and pledged their unity with one another. This is this slide lists the ten different kings, and you can see this in the Golden Oil book, which is published by the House of Yahweh. Toward the end of the book, there's a letter in there that shows this. But I wanted to just show you the countries where these kings came from. First of all, number one, this is from left to right, and the picture may be a little bit smaller for you, but the first one, Metropolitan Sawa of Warsaw and all of Poland. The second one, Archbishop Chrysanthemis of Cyprus. Number three, Patriarch Irene of Serbia. Number four, Patriarch Theodore of Alexandria, Egypt. Number five, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew. He's the leader of the group, so to speak. Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople. Patriarch Theophilus is number six of Jerusalem, Israel. Number seven, wearing the white there, Patriarch Daniel of Romania. Number eight, Archbishop Laronimus of Athens and all of Greece. Number nine, Archbishop Anastasios of Albania. And number 10, Archbishop Ratzislav of the Czech lands and Slovakia. Okay, the last slide here, and one of the boys said, how many slides are you going to have today? 100? 90? I said, how about 44? And he says, okay. This is number 44 here. Revelation 13, verse 1, the beast from the sea. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea. This is peoples, the population of the earth, having seven heads, giving its location, the seven hills of Rome, and ten horns, religious powers, and upon his horns, ten crowns. These are kings, they're religious kings. And upon his head, the names of blasphemy, which is the changing of Yahweh's laws. This is the current status of the Vatican today. It's only been that way for about 2.5 years, as I understand it. And the final statement here is, the ten kings will give their power and authority to the beast from the sea for about 3.5 years, leading to the 1 hour of burning. May Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh bless your understanding. Please stand for closing prayer.